You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, United We Stand, by Anthony Bresnahan, with photos by Norman Jean Roy, styled by Edward Boleg III. Stan gets that protective streak from another person who helped him get where he is, his mother, Georgetta Orlovsky, who also accompanied him to the Oscars. She raised him for many years as a single mom after she split from his father when Stan was young. They were both very strong individuals with very strong personalities, he says. Neither wanted to be justified by the other. I think they both had a rebellious spirit. His father later disappeared completely, going into exile in the States. Constantine Stan was a cargo ship worker who helped fellow countrymen evade government persecution that pervaded Romania in the decades after World War II. He was a bit of a hero in my town, Stan says. My parents were part of the youth that were standing up to communism. My father was helping people escape the country illegally to the point where he was a wanted man, and he himself had to flee. Stan grew up not really knowing the man everyone else knew by the nickname Tino, apart from occasional telephone calls. But if his dad could vanish, it seemed plausible that his mother might too. Then, one day she did. Stan was about 8 years old when his mother fled Romania to set up a new life for them abroad. Throughout his childhood, government mismanagement and corruption had led to food scarcity, fuel shortages, and electricity blackouts. The eventual revolution culminated in the downfall and execution of dictator Nicolae Ceausescu in 1989. I watched him get shot on television, Stan says. I remember that. The aftermath wasn't necessarily better. It was chaos, Stan says, noting how many orphaned kids were in Bucharest after the revolution because everybody didn't have money. Nobody knew how to live. They'd been so suppressed. He spent a year with his grandparents before joining his mother in Austria. She came and got me when she finally had a job and established herself enough there in Vienna, he says. The anxiety he felt about losing her continued even after they were reunited. She was working, she was playing piano at night when she could, and then she was teaching piano all day long. So at 9 or 10 years old, I was taking the trolley to school myself. I was taking the subway back myself, Stan recalls. Then I was coming home, and I was alone, and I would have to make myself food, and I'd do my homework, and I'd wait for her to come home. That was a lot of alone time for a kid in a foreign country. He learned independence, but it scarred him, too. I remember waiting for her to get home and worrying, what if she doesn't come home? I can see how that's worked against me in certain ways, and how it's totally benefited me in other ways. You have a lot of time with your imagination when you're a kid like that alone. So I feel I'm very good at using my imagination to believe certain things, which helps me in a way. But then there are times where I'm feeling a degree of uncertainty and lack of control over my life that can be paralyzing. Stan was around 12 when his mother began dating a man named Anthony Fruhoff, who was the headmaster of a small private high school in central New York. When they got married, Stan's mother made plans to move with her son once again, this time to the United States. He was really kind. My stepdad was a real influence in a good way, Stan says. In those early years in America, speaking English with him at home, I think, probably led to how I lost my accent. He was all right seeing it go. He wanted to belong. All this surfaced when Stan was on stage accepting his Golden Globe. This is for my mom, who left Romania in search of a better life, and for my stepfather, Tony, who took on a single mom and a grown-up kid, he said, hoisting his award as his voice broke. Pointing heavenward, he added, "Thank you for being a real man." Despite craving stability, Stan learned the value of taking chances, which has earned him a daredevil reputation among his actor friends. Sebastian has always been really fearless, says Chris Evans, who first appeared opposite Stan in 2011's Captain America, The First Avenger, and co-starred with him repeatedly as the Marvel Cinematic Universe expanded. You can see that in his choices. He takes big swings. When that Trump movie was kicking around, I remember thinking, I wonder who's going to take this job. It's just got so many strings attached to it, and I was so unsurprised when I heard it was Sebastian. The devil on Stan's shoulder, urging him forward, was Jessica Chastain, who became a close friend after they worked together on 2015's The Martian, and later the 2022 spy thriller The 355. When we were on set for The 355, that's when he first told me he had had the offer to play Donald Trump. A thing about Sebastian that people might not realize is he's very, very thoughtful, almost to a point where he overthinks things. It could cause a little bit of stress. He was like, "Well, what do you think? What would you do?" I said, "Do it." I was like, "What do you have to lose? Take a risk. As long as it doesn't cause you physical danger, if something scares you, do it." Chastain saw Stan do that very thing in 2017's I, Tonya, in which he played Tonya Harding's then-husband, who hatched the scheme to sabotage her rival Nancy Kerrigan. When so many people are trying to make you this conventional movie star, it's a risk to do something that isn't that, Chastain says. He's willing to play unlikable characters. I find that executives have trouble with characters that may be complex and have dark sides to them. He really embraces that. He's not happy to just be a conventional movie star. Marvel Studios was looking for a dark side when they were casting the role of Bucky Barnes in the first Captain America movie in 2010. Stan was a relative unknown, though he'd had a recurring role on Gossip Girl as a pathological liar of a rich kid. You could see that he has so much inside him and so much behind his eyes. I'll never forget that, Feig says. I said to Stephen Broussard, who was one of the producers on Captain America, "He's going to be a good Bucky, but he's going to be a great Winter Soldier." Bucky evolves into that villainous alter ego in subsequent MCU stories, going from fearless soldier to shell-shocked prisoner of war, and eventually mind-controlled assassin who struggles to break his programming and redeem himself. Getting the part was beyond game-changing for the actor. "I was actually struggling with work," Stan says. "I had just gotten off the phone with my business manager, who told me I was saved by $65,000 that came in residuals from Hot Tub Time Machine. He'd played the smarmy bully in that comedy a year before. Now it was his salvation." Since then, the Winter Soldier has become one of the most beloved and relatable characters in the MCU, even though his story is far from the traditional everyman narrative. Bucky resonates because he's damaged goods, the patron saint of F-ups, struggling to do right. The arc culminates in his new lead role in Thunderbolts, with Bucky leading a team of former troublemakers and outcasts. Feig says that without Stan, the character's strange journey wouldn't have been the emotional gut punch it is. After lunch, Stan goes to his appointment at Autonomous FX. The headquarters is tucked near an ice warehouse and a scrapyard in an industrial neighborhood of Van Nuys. Stan is trying on a pair of fake teeth that slip over his perfect pearly whites. The goal is to give him a more regular guy look for Fjord, the movie he's shooting in Norway with filmmaker Christian Mungiu, a fellow native of Romania. There's a story behind these teeth, dating back to before Stan got braces as an adult. "When I got Invisalign, I was so obsessed with them," he says. "The more you wear them, the faster they work. So I actually wore them at the effing Captain America the Winter Soldier premiere. I have them in, and I'm smiling with them, and people can tell. I was self-conscious, because my teeth were always a little..." He splays his fingers into crooked angles. The prosthetic teeth are modeled on Stan's own before he fixed them. Stan has another blast from his past waiting for him, too. After the fitting, Joan Collins. Well, let's make that Jason Collins, the founder and lead creative force behind Autonomous FX, takes Stan through the workshops where sculptors are making limbs, bodies, and demonic babies. On the shelves, busts of other actors like Christian Bale and Annette Bening, used for previous projects, stare down with vacant eyes. Collins and his company essentially provide the level-up version of the fake beards and noses that Stan first loved about acting in high school, except occasionally X-rated. As part of this nostalgia trip, Collins brings out a plastic tub with the remains of the robotic erection from Pam and Tommy. The latex has dried out and decayed away. This penis character was voiced by Jason Mantzoukas and had strong opinions about the Motley Crue drummer's romance with the Baywatch star. It was a risky creative choice by the showrunners, but added levity to the series and was inspired by Lee's own autobiography, in which he banters philosophically with his sex organ. The makeup team and the actor forged a bond along the way. It really becomes a partnership, Collins says. We stare at him for weeks and months at a time, so we know the physical structure. We know what the span of his legs is and all that other stuff. You get to know the actor very well, says Stan. Their earliest meeting involved figuring out how to fit a prosthetic over his actual privates and snake cables for the controls down his backside. When I first came here, they made a replica to work on, so they had to cast this, Stan says, gesturing to his crotch. I remember you're like, all right, buddy, well, I guess it's good to meet you. After the makeup shop, Stan heads for the last stop of the day, the Orthodox Church. After a persuasive conversation in Romanian, the custodian agrees to unlock the chapel for him. Bitsi kapana, Stan says. You'll see it's only for a moment. As the doors swing open, the faces of saints stare down at us from rows of miniature shrines, not unlike the bust of the famous actors in the prosthetics lab. Both places represent things Stan believes in, the ability to transform into something new, and a yearning to connect with something beyond yourself. Stan doesn't claim to be especially religious, but the Holy Trinity Chapel takes him back to that fearful time living under communist dictatorship, when he put his faith in higher powers and prayed for the best. We would go to church a lot when I was little, he says. It's still tied into certain things for me because I felt such a degree of powerlessness over decisions being made early on. Stan and the man he wants to commemorate with a candle were estranged for years. He and his father finally reconnected when Stan was around 18 and began visiting Los Angeles for auditions. The New York kid would save money by staying with his father, who had settled in the San Fernando Valley, not far from the makeup shop, actually, and worked once again in shipping. The periodic visits brought them closer, and the relationship stayed tight until his dad died unexpectedly from COVID on a trip back to Romania in 2021. Stan sometimes thinks his father's story might make a good movie. In Romania, Tino was legendary for sneaking contraband Western goods like blue jeans and bananas into the country while smuggling dissidents out aboard the same vessels. He worked hard, and he loved America, and he believed in being free, Stan says. I have always made the argument that immigrants, to some extent, are more patriotic than even the people that are born here, because they don't take things for granted. At least that's what I saw in my father. The janitor guides us to the back of the church, where there's a small side room with a votive stand arrayed with unlit candles. Can you give me 1 second? I'll be right back, Stan says. He disappears into the shadowy alcove and strikes a light. Later, driving away from the chapel, Stan tries to explain why he felt so compelled to go there. I think it's just the acknowledgement of how fragile we all are. Sometimes you go somewhere where it's really not about you. It's a moment to let go, turn off for a while, he says. You don't have to be anything in there. You don't have to think any which way. He says something similar via text 2 weeks later when he's in Norway, starting work on his new role in Fjord, with his new teeth that resemble his old teeth. The feeling is always the same, like it's the first time, Stan writes. It's always a mix of fear and hope. It's losing yourself. It's a free fall. Every time. change agent, ex-CIA analyst Alyssa Slotkin, the moderate freshman senator from Michigan, is a rising Democratic star in a party that desperately needs them. By Marie Brenner, with photographs by Frankie Alduino. The scene inside the vault of the National Archives could have been scripted by Aaron Sorkin, then quickly dismissed as a cheesy throwback to a bygone era. On November 12, 2024, 8 members of the newly elected freshman class of senators were on Constitution Avenue to tour the treasures of the archive, including handwritten drafts of the Bill of Rights and the original Emancipation Proclamation. The ritual is a moment for incoming Republicans and Democrats to come together without their staffs and literally hold the nation's history in their hands. But for one newbie senator, Michigan Democrat Alyssa Slotkin, the visit was especially poignant, as were the contents of one Pearl Gray archive case. Inside that box, she told me later, was the original George Washington pledge to not swear fealty to any king. Surrounded by starving troops at Valley Forge as they battled for American independence, Washington had signed the first copy of that 1778 oath, signed in turn by officers and infantry, which would assert that the people of the United States owe no allegiance or obedience to the tyrannical despot George III. I began to vibrate, the self-described history nerd told me, recounting how she marveled at the tactile power of that fragile slip of paper. Pictures weren't really allowed, but I managed to get one to post on social media. Slotkin was determined, she said, that her Michigan constituents be made aware of the vows and sacrifices that had shaped the young nation, whose democratic values were being grievously challenged as she took her seat in the Senate. I had come to see her in early December as she ramped up plans for her first 100 days in office and for confronting President Donald Trump's return to power. She could already feel, she said, the cold wind from the dragon swinging his tail up and down Pennsylvania Avenue. It was the first of several lengthy talks we would have over the next 3 months, as Slotkin, 48, found her footing. And indeed she did. A month into Trump's second term, she would become a persistent presence on the Hill, on social media, and on television, whether talking with CNN's Christiane Amanpour or the panelist on The View, denouncing the excesses of the administration. Upon returning from the Munich Security Conference in February, she would go so far as to openly call out the Trump team's ignorance for sidelining Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in peace talks, and Trump himself for appeasing Russia's Vladimir Putin. Ronald Reagan must be rolling over in his grave right now, she said, later adding, if you're Vladimir Putin, you're popping champagne in Moscow. And then all hell broke loose. In a shameful Oval Office takedown of a world leader fighting off a tyrant whose army had invaded his country, Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance bullied Zelensky like sullen toddlers, demanding fealty, then later announcing they were pausing all aid to Ukraine. Slotkin at the time was locked away with her advisors. She'd been tapped by party leaders to deliver the Democratic response to Trump's address to a joint session of Congress, so she and several of her aides were working on the final draft, only to look over and see her phone blow up with text from her peers, voicing their alarm. Shortly thereafter, she watched a replay of the televised encounter in disgust. The following Monday, the day before she would face the nation, Slotkin hopped on a phone call as she was putting the finishing touches on her talk. Her anger was still palpable. You better believe I strengthened the hell out of the national security portion, Slotkin told me, to call him out. We have seen Donald Trump act as if he is in the thrall of Vladimir Putin, and it has gotten worse and worse. The Zelensky meeting was an absolute symbol of his cozying up to dictators and kicking our allies in the teeth. To just give over all the cards to Vladimir Putin and then shift our foreign policy and our intelligence operations is so outside the norm of the last 80 years, I don't even know how to process it. What's more, she said, she was appalled that at least one of the Republican legislators who had been with her in Munich and had met with Zelensky in Washington prior to his White House drubbing had scrubbed his social media feed, cleaning it of the encomium he'd posted just hours before. It's not just Trump. It's that the rest of them have capitulated to his approach. My fundamental split with Trump is that he doesn't see American leadership as exceptional. American leadership is not perfect, but I will take American leadership over Chinese or Russian leadership any day of the week. On the next night, she gave her party's response, live from Wyandotte, Michigan, a town that both she and Trump had won in the general election. She deftly reminded the country of the American dream that her home state symbolized. You could work at an auto plant and afford the car you were building, summoning a way of life now under threat from Trump's first weeks of wreckage, epitomized by the gutting of government agency jobs by Trump and his Rasputin Elon Musk. Is there anyone in America who is comfortable with him and his gang of 20-year-olds using their own computer servers to poke through your private data? The spectacle in the Oval Office wasn't just a bad episode of reality TV, Slotkin said. It summed up Trump's whole approach to the world. Had he been in office in the 1980s, she contended, Trump would have lost us the Cold War. His speech to Congress, a 100-minute peroration of braggadocio, nasty insults, and falsehoods, was met by an embarrassing and inchoate Democratic Party, some holding silly paddles, false, Musk steals, others stalking out, and one showboating Texas congressman causing an uproar. In this fever dream of grotesque, paranoid politics, Slotkin's normalcy and fierce love of country seemed to conjure the kind of Democrat forged in a much earlier era. Slotkin urged her listeners to attend town halls and mobilize on issues that matter. Don't tune out, she admonished. Doom scrolling doesn't count. It's easy to be exhausted, but America needs you now more than ever. If previous generations had not fought for democracy, where would we be today? To secure her Senate seat, Slotkin prevailed by 19,000 votes in a purple Midwestern state that Trump carried by 80,000. Slotkin ran as a radical pragmatist. During her campaign, she cited bipartisan bills she'd helped get through the House during three terms in Congress and spoke of her membership in the Problem Solvers Caucus, a group established by Republicans and Democrats to draft legislation across the aisle. Her strategy was to keep her message character-driven, said her campaign manager, Matt Hennessy. Our move was to just go straight bio. Alyssa, full face to the camera. What you see told the tale. The grueling contest became one of the most expensive in Senate history. Slotkin and her allies spent $129 million, a good portion of it fighting off what she called storms of disinformation, as her opponent, Mike Rogers, the former head of the House Intelligence Committee and a Trump critic turned MAGA warrior, returned from his residence in Florida to take her on. For his part, Rogers and his political supporters spent $76 million, with some of their media blast seeking to link Slotkin, a centrist Democrat who claims to be decidedly outside the woke camp, to the progressive agenda and the Biden White House, even falsely accusing her of having connections to a Chinese-run electric vehicle battery company. In the photos, Alyssa Slotkin at her Michigan farm. Slotkin at Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's January hearing, delivering the Democratic response to Donald Trump's joint session of Congress address in March. "We would wake up every morning praying we wouldn't be hit with another $5 million in attack ads," her campaign communications head Austin Cook recalled. With each charge, her team pivoted with a new commercial. Barack Obama starred in one, describing Slotkin's foreign policy expertise while she served on his national security staff. But that experience cut both ways, as did her background as a CIA analyst who'd clocked three tours in Iraq, not necessarily a selling point with progressives. A few weeks before the election, Slotkin's pro-Israel record and staunch stand against anti-Semitism threatened to implode the Michigan Democratic Coalition as the war in Gaza escalated and Israel began major airstrikes in Lebanon. Lebanese Americans make up the largest segment of Michigan's sizable Arab American community. But Slotkin stood firm. A fluent Arabic speaker, she told one reporter that she had deep concerns about what's going on with Israel's military campaign. "You can express empathy and concern and nuance, even when conversations are difficult." For her admirers, if any three words captured the candidate's essence, it was these: empathy, concern, nuance. In the end, she carried the Arab-American majority of Dearborn. By December, Slotkin found herself in a demoralized Washington, D.C., a deep blue city reeling from Trump's popular vote victory and his first cabinet picks, the ill-fated Matt Gaetz for attorney general, the TV he-man Pete Hegseth for defense secretary. Slotkin had already made a name among party mandarins. With her military and White House pedigree, easy rapport, and low-key Midwestern directness, she seemed to many insiders a future standard-bearer for a more moderate vision, a politician who might be able to bring back common sense to a Democratic Party that was off its moorings. If the party had more candidates like Alyssa Slotkin, they would have won, James Carville remarked. Another Democratic activist told me, "The question is Alyssa Slotkin 4 years out or 8 years out from party leadership? We all know she's a star." To former Homeland Security Advisor Lisa Monaco, who worked with Slotkin in the Obama White House, the senator's mastery of foreign affairs and lightness of affect make her, for me, someone whose leadership voice should be heard, and I mean now. Slotkin would have a promising start. Her appearances at cabinet confirmation hearings highlighted her candor and insight. Other lawmakers were paying attention. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer told me he'd been impressed by her insistence on rethinking the standard playbook in twice-weekly sessions held by the Democratic caucus. "Suddenly," he said, "everyone is listening intently to what she is saying, and she has no issue of taking longtime Senate policy and saying, even though she is brand new, how do we challenge this?" In March, she would go on Meet the Press and assert, "New senators, new representatives, new folks who were like, hey, we need to do more, and we need to be showing that we're actually having a plan to stand up on really important moments of inflection. So that's what I'm trying to do from within." Slotkin earned her uncommon reputation in the House while representing the district that surrounds the state capital of Lansing and tips into the farthest corner of the sprawling Detroit suburbs, Trump country. There in the town of Holly, population 5,938, she lives down a dirt road in a modest two-story farmhouse bought by her grandfather in the 1950s as a cattle farm and weekend retreat. The barn is painted a muted red, not unlike the political leanings of many living nearby. The cows have long been replaced by soybeans, planted in fields leased to neighbors. Slotkin's granular understanding of the concerns of the rural, middle, and working class voters in her community had set her apart during her 6 weeks in Congress. She understood that Holly, with its proximity to Detroit and its blue-collar families, was a Rorschach for the country. Visiting almost every county in the state during her campaign, Slotkin would dive into farmers' markets and diners with a sense of affinity, part therapist, part neighbor, taking in voters' stories and sharing her own. "I am a people person," she insisted. "I have been this way since childhood." Her smile had a gravitational pull, even when she'd make jokes about carrying a Glock, which plays well in Michigan. At the height of her campaign, she told a group at a New York fundraiser I attended, "We are underwater. I'm not going to carry my own district. My neighbors can't give their kids the same quality of life they have had, and they are angry and ashamed and blame the Democrats. I keep trying to get the party to understand this. I tried to warn the Biden team and got nowhere. Kamala's team is better, but wasn't great." Her words would prove prophetic for many Democrats. But unlike many of her peers, the Michigander seemed in tune with the electorate. At year's end, Slotkin was setting up temporary quarters on the 8th floor of the Hart Senate office building, not far from the Committee on Indian Affairs. Cubicles overflowed with packing boxes. New hires sat on benches in a hallway. On one wall, in a small conference room that Slotkin had commandeered as her office, she had hung a red and yellow abstract painting of a hot dog, a tribute to her great-grandfather, an immigrant who had started what would become the nationally known high-grade meat company. The Slotkin family story is about as American as it gets. 9 Jewish siblings, originally from the Pale of Settlement, would include Samuel Slotkin, a Minsk immigre who arrived in 1900 and eventually set up High Grade, a behemoth that would fan out across America. In 1946, The New Yorker profiled him in a lengthy story, stating, "Samuel Slotkin believes he succeeded in business because he has the soul of an artist, creating beautiful frankfurters and sausage, and that money has crept on him unawares." In the late 50s, his son, Hugo, would mastermind a new spice blend that would make a superior hot dog. Their family firm, sold before Alyssa Slotkin was born, would become Ballpark Franks, an iconic brand carried in sports stadiums and supermarkets. The company was featured prominently in her campaign commercials. Hot dogs were served at her Senate swearing-in party at Washington Spy Museum. The venue was a statement as well. Slotkin is the first former CIA officer to serve in the upper chamber, having been in and out of war zones for more than a decade. Indeed, during the race, images of a young Slotkin in a flak jacket deluged the Michigan airwaves. So too did her resume. Under George W. Bush and Obama, she had served 4 defense secretaries, becoming Obama's acting assistant secretary of defense for international security affairs. In those first weeks, she would tell visitors, "I am the 64th woman senator, the 4th Jewish woman senator, and the youngest woman Democrat in the Senate." That sense of awe would soon be eclipsed by the urgency of a crisis that threatened to upend all norms of governance through the sweeping rollbacks of Trump and his amanuensis Musk, the world's richest man, deputized to bring the federal government to heel. Slotkin decried a group of billionaires leading this administration around by the nose. Suddenly, Slotkin was engaged in activities way outside the usual portfolio for a freshman senator. Instead of devoting her efforts to angling for subcommittee opportunities, she was rigorously preparing for battle, studying case law about the separation of powers, and joining other senators in legal actions against the new president. She is wary of using words like coup or push. But within her first days in office, Trump and Vance, a Yale law graduate, issued stunning ukases contending that federal court judges did not have jurisdiction over the executive branch, an assertion that even most middle schoolers would find absurd. As she had in the House, Slotkin would confer often with confidants from both parties. Her closest friends in politics are two centrist Democrats, former congressional colleagues who share her military and intelligence background. New Jersey's Mikey Sherrill and Virginia's Abigail Spanberger, both now running for governor of their respective states. Slotkin, at one point, reached out to Monaco, Joe Biden's deputy attorney general, to consult on legal strategy as 22 state attorneys general, including Michigan's, filed multiple suits in federal courts to push back against Trump's tide of executive orders. "I want her to come in and help run these cases," Slotkin told me. But soon after their conversation, as if to underscore the gravity of the moment, the administration would revoke Monaco's security clearance and that of scores of other current and former officials, many of whom would suffer the added insult of being denied access to federal buildings. In cramped offices, Slotkin's staff was fielding nonstop messages from apoplectic Michiganders, Republican and Democrat. "We have had almost 5,000 calls in 3 days," she told me. "Mayors, veterans, sheriffs, cancer researchers, town superintendents, students, the elderly. All these lives had suddenly been upended, and constituents were turning to their senator, irate that their benefits had been cut, their jobs eliminated, their school funds halted." The word, she said, that best described her first month, chaos. A close second, overreach. While she was getting settled in the Capitol, Slotkin was also opening an office in Detroit, hiring 40 new staffers, and hoping that her committee assignments might include a coveted appointment for a junior senator, the Armed Services Committee. In addition, she was trying to master the arcana of Senate protocol as well as prepare briefing books on her new peers to understand where they might share common ground for future legislation. Next photo, Slotkin at home in Holly, Michigan, population 5,938. Her day-to-day agenda, though, still seemed forged in an era governed by a shared belief in the rule of law. She was speaking out against an attempt by a Japanese company to take over U.S. Steel, a move that threatened Michigan's auto industry. She was brainstorming with her legislative aide, Ani Toumajan, about what would become her first Senate bill, a ban on selling export oil to foreign adversaries like China and Russia, which she would co-sponsor with Pennsylvania's John Fetterman and Texas Republican Ted Cruz. "No one can out-hawk me on China," she told me, sounding for a moment like Trump himself. But the next instant, she seemed to echo Biden, who had stood with Wayne County auto workers on the picket line. "The Venn diagram I am working in for Michigan is bringing back our manufacturing jobs and protecting our national security." She was clearly in overdrive, trying to keep Chinese manufactured cars out of the U.S. "What do we want?" she asked. "A fleet of Chinese spy craft gathering information near our security sites?" She was especially focused on Michigan's defense manufacturing and military bases. The state has the country's largest National Guard training center. On the Senate floor, she would name-check Musk for allegedly placating China, which hosts Tesla plants in Shanghai. She blasted out a tweet on Musk-owned platform X, then a post on Threads in support of her constituents and Detroit-area automakers. Musk's personal interest from his vast investments in communist China to his opposition to the Big Three, simply don't align with the interests of the average Michigander. Then, in late January, the chill swept in, and with it, the Trump avalanche. First came talk of tariffs, which would threaten to cripple the Michigan auto industry and affect virtually every consumer in her state. Then came the freezing of federal grants. Then Musk and his Nerd Reich, as several wags called it, unleashed a squad of 20-somethings, their security clearance status uncertain, across a raft of federal agencies. At the same time, there were moves toward large-scale deportations, purges, buyouts, layoffs, mass firings. Every day, it seemed, her team had to react to a new barrage of outlandish or illegal declarations. Trump proclaimed his designs on Canada, Greenland, and the Panama Canal. He called for the U.S. to assume control of Gaza. By February, dozens of lawsuits had been filed against the executive branch, some of which had come after consultations with her office. Slotkin was already primed. George W. Bush's national security advisor, Stephen Hadley, describing Slotkin as fearless, told me that her skill set as a leader is unique. At the CIA, her portfolio had included countering Middle East terrorist groups. In 2007, as a member of Bush's national security team, she was in Baghdad, fielding reports that 107-millimeter rocket shells had landed on the lawn of the American embassy. Were they coming from Iran? Slotkin was on the ground and told her then-boss, Douglas Lute, later Obama's NATO ambassador, who was in Washington, "I've seen the fragments, and they are stamped with USA labeling. They could be legacy Saddam vintage stuff. They could be from Jordan." The illicit arms trade in the region made it difficult to pinpoint their origin. "You're coming home tomorrow," Lute recalled telling Slotkin. "Bring me something I can show the president." So, Alyssa, being Alyssa, appeared at my office the next day and dropped a 20-pound, 18-inch shell fragment on my desk, marked with English munitions labeling. "Here is your evidence," she said. "I don't like being shelled." In Baghdad, she served with Corin Stone, who would later become the Pentagon's deputy general counsel. Stone was among Slotkin's first hires to help mastermind her Senate legal strategy against a Trump team dead set on dismantling vital institutions. None of this came as a surprise to Lute. The disorder brought about by the government's demolition crews will look familiar to her, he said, pointing out how she has been there when countries slip toward authoritarianism and empower people like Musk, who are not responsible and not accountable. She will recognize this by way of the dysfunction in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Russia. Her international experience will give her touch points. Russia was particularly germane. In 2014, Slotkin was at the Pentagon when reports began to surface of Russian troops close to the Ukrainian border. "We wondered, is it possible this is cover for going into Crimea?" she recalled. "And then the tanks started rolling in. As an analyst, I understood this had been a failure of imagination, the same thing we are struggling with right now with Ukraine." The following year, she said, we also saw Russia mobilizing aircraft over Syria. They were there as advisors. And we thought, are they really going to do their first deployment since Afghanistan? But we had much more imagination after Crimea. And Ash Carter, Obama's defense secretary, was like, screw that, we're not going to yield to the Russians. He had me draw up rules so we would not have to risk two nuclear powers accidentally running into each other over Syria. In a secure conference room, Slotkin was tasked with negotiating with the Russian generals in charge of the operation. They didn't want to lose their pilots either. I always wondered if Ash had me lead it because I was an American woman facing down three aging Russian generals. In the many hours we spent together, that was one of the only times that Slotkin mentioned her gender. During the campaign, she told me, she often pressed her predecessor, retiring Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow, 74, about what she went through as a woman in the Senate. I was like, oh my God, I have been in male-dominated fields my entire life. I can't tell you how many rooms I have been in where I'm the only woman with 3- and 4-star generals, the CIA. There was never one day of my professional life that I was like, how do I get a man to champion this idea so I can get it done? Not one day. It was hardly a surprise when Slotkin landed the plum post, Armed Services. She was also assigned to three more slots that play to her strengths, Agriculture, Homeland Security, and Veterans Affairs. As a result, right after being sworn in, she would need to prepare to go one-on-one on national television, displaying her Security and Intelligence Medal during hearings for cabinet nominees. Three would soon be in her crosshairs, and she in theirs. Hegseth, Russell Voigt, the budget czar and a Project 2025 co-author, and would-be Homeland Security Chief Kristi Noem. I first met Slotkin in the summer of 2022 at a New York fundraiser given by a cousin of mine. I had heard about her growing reputation from yet another cousin who was part of a group of dynamic Democratic Michiganders that also included former Governor Jennifer Granholm, State Attorney General Dana Nessel, and current Governor Gretchen Whitmer. I was curious about this ballsy CIA analyst who was now running for her third term in Congress not long after Roe v. Wade had been reversed. In front of a small group gathered in East Hampton, Slotkin radiated an uncanny political certitude. What is it with the Democratic Party? Why wasn't there a legal strategy in place a decade ago to prevent this from happening? All of these pro-abortion groups, and they couldn't have figured this out? Why are we, as a party, always playing defense? My training in the CIA is about planning. You have to have a plan. A plan is everything. The next summer, Slotkin was back in the Hamptons, eyeing a Senate run. This time, I was curious about her interactions with Elise Stefanik, an ex-colleague on Bush's national security team. Stefanik, a Harvard grad close to her in age, seemed to have a measured temperament and a core of constitutional values. Both Slotkin and Stefanik, Trump's erstwhile nominee for UN ambassador, had broad foreign affairs experience, though they differed on policy. Under Bush, their relationship was distant but cordial in Slotkin's estimation. In the House, they had worked together on several bills, and at the time, said Slotkin, Elise was much more moderate than she is today. But after a while, Stefanik threw in with a MAGA group that filed a brief to try to decertify the results of the 2020 election. She savagely attacked the January 6th committee and its vice chair, fellow Republican Liz Cheney, calling her a Pelosi pawn. Stefanik would soon turn full MAGA mean girl, later announcing that she would not have done what Mike Pence did in certifying the election in 2020. That summer of 2023, I was researching the motivations that drove collaborators to throw in their lot with authoritarian regimes. I was trying to understand the moral amnesia that had taken hold of many level-headed legislators who once in Trump world had abandoned their humanist values. Slotkin looked at me closely, surprised by my naivete. There's one word that explains it, she said, ambition. So what do you say to Elise, I ask, when you see each other in Congress? If I am in the elevator with her, she said, I will look down and get busy with my phone. A while later, when Stefanik posted a petty anti-Biden tweet with Slotkin pictured in the background, she had had enough. After that, it was a full metamorphosis, I realized we can no longer have a serious conversation. Insurrection Day would become for Slotkin the ultimate test of character. The violence of January 6th was a turning point. Before that, I would have said, look, there's two types of Republicans I work with. The true believers, who really feel strongly and deeply that they love Donald Trump and believe and support a lot of what he says. Then there's the other category, and they know better, and they don't like him. Sometimes they dislike him as much as we do. January 6th, you barricade yourself in your office and look for a weapon, and it gives you some clarity. That, to me, was like if you don't say anything and you vote with him, you're actually maybe worse because you are covering. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman. Today's broadcast is in memory of my maternal grandfather, who taught me to question everything.